We're very pleased to have Professor, or sorry, to have Mr. Ward Connerly. He's a former UC Regent, and he's also the president of the American Civil Rights Institute. To introduce Mr. Connerly formally will be our own Professor Jeffries. So let's please give a hand to both gentlemen.
I handed out to you a resume, and Ward said to me, don't go on and on and on. So I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to tell you the highlights from what I can see. First of all, I remember his name in 1994 when I was a younger lawyer and was very impressed about his efforts to bring some sanity to our educational system. Mr. Connerly is a founder and president of the American Civil Rights Institute, a national not-for-profit organization aiming at educating the public about the need to move beyond race, and specifically race and gender preferences. Mr. Connerly gained national attention as an outspoken advocate of equal opportunity for all Americans, regardless of race, sex, or ethnic background. He's written two books here, Creating Equal, My Fight Against Race Preferences, and his new release, Lessons from My Uncle James, Beyond Skin Color to the Content of Our Character. When he was at the University of California Board of Regents, he had 24-hour police protection ordered by the governor because of the positions he was taking were very unpopular. He is a courageous, honest, and wonderful advocate for not only the rule of law, but sanity. So I give you Ward Connerly.
We have some emergency pizza, so I'll just be right back to my food.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Jeffries. Whenever I hear such an introduction, I'm always tempted to say I don't deserve that. But I have hay fever, and I don't deserve that either, so I'll accept it. Race is always a very contentious issue. I learned that when it was reinforced during my 12-year sentence on the Board of Regents. Regardless of where you come down on the use of race in the body politic, I hope that we can approach the issue of what is commonly called affirmative action with a strong measure of objectivity and willingness to listen to opposing points of view and to be dissuaded if the facts are proven and set us free. I'm always viewed as a controversial figure, at least among law school students and others on college campuses. And I really don't know why that is, because I think the law is clearly on my side here. And the position I take in our country, which is that everybody should be accorded the right to equal treatment by their government, doesn't seem to me to be a controversial position. In fact, I think that those who argue to the contrary are the ones who embrace a controversial view. But I'm also struck by the fact that many, even those on my side of this issue, think that it's novel or somehow unseemly that a brown-skinned guy would be advancing the notion that race preferences or affirmative action or actions by the government to influence college enrollment or who gets hired or who gets a contract, that I should be taking such a position. And so with that preface, let me just give you a little bit of background about my background, and perhaps that will allow you to better understand the position that I take and why I do. I was born in the Deep South, Leesville, Louisiana, in 1939. My father left the house when I was 2 years old, and I didn't see him for 58 years thereafter. In fact, he was on his deathbed, literally on his deathbed, when I saw him. And I have no regrets about his absence from my life, as I will unveil to you in the course of my comments. My mother died when I was 4, and I have much regret about that. I think that we all benefit from the loving, benevolent hand of a mother. It's just something about that relationship of mother and child that you cannot replace, no matter how others enter your life and seek to influence it. When my mother died, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, became my custodian. And she lived in Leesville, Louisiana, and she had 6 children of her own. And she did not want me growing up in the Deep South. So she dispatched me to live with one of her other sisters, Aunt Bert, and Aunt Bert's husband, James Lewis. James Lewis was a man who never got beyond the 3rd grade. But he had a deep sense of self-respect, a very, what you might call, conservative view about the role of a father, the role of a citizen in this country. He believed devoutly that everybody needed to be a productive person. And he especially believed that if you were of the male species, you had a responsibility to be a productive man, as he called it, M-A-N-E, meaning man. You had to take care of your family. You had to work hard. He loved to hunt. That was a way of providing for his family when jobs were scarce or when the weather was bad and Uncle James couldn't pile wood or dig ditches at the construction yard. But more than anything else, Uncle James instilled in me in the notion that society didn't owe me a damn thing. That if I was going to be successful, I had to take matters into my own hands and make sure that I was prepared to face whatever contingencies came along. He would say, the world doesn't owe you SH, and you better not expect it because you're not going to get it. And it's especially rough if you're a black kid. So, James Lewis implanted in me the notion that I had to prepare myself and not be contingent, my future contingent upon what others might do for me. Independence was not only the order of the day in James Lewis's life, it's the way most black people viewed circumstances in the South and indeed in America during that era. We shall overcome was the prevailing chant of the civil rights movement. We shall overcome, meaning that the responsibility for getting beyond the oppressions of American life were ours. It's not that we were going to be reliant upon what others would do for us. So I left that period with that sense that I could rise or fall on my own, and that if I did not succeed, it was my responsibility, it was my failure, not because somebody else didn't give it to me. I went to Mary in 1962 after I had graduated from college. I went to Sac State, and I'd gone to a community college. And I learned that in most parts of the country, my marriage to my wife was against the law, because the government had prescribed that blacks and whites could not marry. And so once again, I found that my government was intruding into how I would live my life, telling me who I could marry. We went to get, my wife and I went to get an apartment. And when she would go out during the day, there were abundant housing opportunities available. When I joined her after I got home from work and she was going to show me this multitude of housing opportunities, lo and behold, many of them became filled because of the color of my skin. They didn't want blacks in their apartment complexes. So, time and time again, as a child, as an adult, young adult, I found that race was influencing my life. Now, one could look at that and take the position that I am owed something by my government because of the disadvantages that had been meted out to me. One could also, as I did, come away from that experience and say, this isn't right. It isn't right that it happened to me, and it isn't right that it happened to anybody else, whether they are black or white or Latino or Asian or Native American or vegetarian, whatever. It isn't right that the government picks and chooses winners, or that the private sector discriminates against people on the basis of their background in American life. But certainly it isn't right for the government to take our tax dollars and to pick winners and losers on the basis of characteristics over which we have no control. That just seemed to me to violate everything that I had been taught in the educational system and by my Uncle James about what it means to be an American. And so when I was asked to serve on the Board of Regents of the University of California by a very good friend, Pete Wilson, I went on there with no agenda about this issue. I had a small business in Sacramento. I was comfortable, but I went there with the idea that I would do the best that I could as a regent. I discovered during my second year on the board, when I was serving as the chair of the finance system, of this finance committee, that the University of California at Berkeley, the most academically rigorous campus in the UC system, had a grid point system that meted out points, actual points, to students on the basis of their race and ethnic background. If you were an underrepresented minority, black, Hispanic, Native American, especially the first two, UC could give you as much as 250 to 1,250 extra points just because you checked the box indicating, in your opinion, that that's what your background was. I saw that and I said, this does not seem to me to be consistent with the famous Bakke decision, where race could be one of many factors. But in my opinion, race had become the factor, because you could only qualify for those extra points if you were an underrepresented minority. And I felt that this was a lawsuit waiting to happen. So I went to the general counsel and I said, Jim, I'm not a lawyer, but I have a fiduciary responsibility over the finance committee. And at Berkeley, we're giving explicit points. At UC Davis, we are admitting all underrepresented minorities, a term that I hate, but that's what we use. All of them, regardless of their background or their academic standing. At San Diego, we are giving extra points, up to 100 points, to those who are underrepresented minorities. I said, are these things constitutional? And as most UC administrators will do, he hemmed and hawed and bobbed and weaved, and finally he said, probably not. And I said, probably not is good enough for me, because I don't think that it is as a policy matter, and I'm going to try to do something about it. So I propose to my colleagues that we end the system of race-based affirmative action. That was in 94 that I mentioned it to the regents. What I had learned between the time that I announced my intention to end this and the actual vote, which came on June 20th, 1995, was that at Berkeley, for example, the highest achieving group at Berkeley were black students. Small in number, but they were the highest achieving, academically achieving students at Berkeley. And I thought, one will never know this, because it doesn't fit with the stereotype that black kids can't get in without the benevolence of affirmative action. And I concluded, it's marginalizing kids. It's marginalizing them. I also learned that there was a great mismatch. Students that should be going possibly to UC Irvine or UC Santa Cruz, no disrespect for those two, but clearly they're not in the same league academically with Berkeley and UCLA and San Diego now and Santa Barbara. Those are the four most competitive institutions. So for those reasons, I put my resolution forward, SB1, and it passed in a very hotly contested campaign on my part to get the regents to vote for it. Subsequent to that, we went to the people of California, and they passed Proposition 209 by a 55-45% margin that applied what the regents had done statewide. You will hear from those who oppose us that Connerly ended affirmative action. That's not quite true. Let me share with you the language of Proposition 209 and my resolution. First, 209, and that really is the essence of what my resolution is. The state, small s, the state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public education, public employment, or public contracting. We made exception for bona fide classifications based on gender. We didn't want to have anyone interpreting this that there could not be female bathrooms, for example, or that there had to be a male searching a female in prison. Those were the bona fide exemptions. When 209 passed, again, the opposition said, I've ended affirmative action. They don't tell you that I also passed a resolution that would allow the university to implement a system called comprehensive review. Comprehensive review means that we could give preference, if we wanted to students who'd never had a parent go to college. We could give it to students who went to certain K-12 schools and who were unprepared by reason of not having the advanced placement courses at their schools. At Berkeley, for example, and UCLA, each year we were getting between 49,000 and 51,000 applicants competing for 4,500 seats. We could fill every one of those seats and never get below 4.2. Yet we had been admitting students with as low as 780 SATs and turning away Asian and white kids with as much as a 1480 SAT. That's what we were doing. And so I concluded that The reason that we were turning away so many kids with a 4.0 and 1400 SAT was because a lot of those kids who went to the more disadvantaged campuses didn't even have access to advanced placement courses. So how can you get a 4.2 if you go to my high school, Grant Union High School in Sacramento, and they don't even offer an advanced placement course? There's no way that you can get above a 4.0. So we implemented a system of comprehensive review to allow the university to mitigate those disadvantages that were there. So that gives you some setting of where we are. Since then, we have found that the graduation rate for underrepresented students at many of our campuses has shot up profoundly. At UC San Diego, for example, the graduation rate for black kids has doubled. Prior to that, there were kids who were washing out in the first quarter because they could not compete against kids who had much higher grade point averages and SATs. I don't care what your color is. If you're competing against someone who is, or ones who are far more prepared, you're gonna have to struggle, and you may not win in that struggle. So what we did is we readjusted affirmative action to allow it to be based on socioeconomic factors rather than race. And gender was irrelevant because women were outperforming men anyway. And 55% of our campuses were female. Law schools where women were predominating, were dominant in the law schools, so much so nationwide that some schools were considering affirmative action for males. Women had to have somebody to date. So there was really no need for affirmative action for females at that period. Now, here we are today, almost 50 years after John F. Kennedy started affirmative action. Almost 50 years after that. Approaching 50 years after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We've had the Bakke decision, which said that race could be one of many factors in 78. We've had the Grutter decision and Gratz decisions that reaffirm that diversity could be, not had to be, but could be a rationale for the use of race in the undergraduate schools as well as graduate schools. But Sandra Day O'Connor, in her opinion, made it very clear that she hoped that the day would come, and she said 25 years, when race-based preferences, her term, would no longer be necessary. What I have been trying to do is to make the case to my fellow Americans that we need to hasten that 25-year clock and get beyond race. Not only get beyond race preferences, but get beyond our preoccupation with race, which is basically color. And I would think that the overwhelming majority of Americans would subscribe to that view. The colorblind approach is the antithesis of this diversity model that many universities seem hell-bent to implement. The two are in conflict. I'm not an opponent of diversity, as long as it happens on the natural. And I believe that in a society where people are presumed as part of our creed to be created equal, if they're treated as equals, diversity will be the outcome of that. And the government should not be moving people around on this board to create this artificial mixture in the student bodies and in the workplace and in contracting. So that's where I come from on this issue. We have a president whose parents are black and white. That suggests to me that the American people, for the most part, are willing to look at candidates for the highest office in the land on the basis of the attributes that they bring rather than their race or skin color. We've just gone through a campaign in this state in which one of the wealthiest people in the world, a woman, was competing for the position of governor. So it's pretty hard to say that Meg Whitman has somehow been oppressed. Now, clearly, two or three examples do not a generality make. But I think that they are sufficiently compelling to cause us to rethink this whole notion of granting preferences on the basis of race, sex, ethnic background. Something that was, that is, by definition in our country, suspect. It's something that we should automatically question. The courts have said that these considerations are to be allowed only with the strictest of interpretations and scrutiny in our country. So that's where I'm coming from, and let me kind of open it up there for any questions that you might have, and we can interact together. You mean I've sold it? Yes.
Thank you for speaking. And what I wanted to kind of say was that I'm actually against affirmative action in the workplace, because I think it should be, you know, we should end up with the most qualified person, you know what I mean, within maybe some limitations, unless there's like obvious racism and that kind of thing. However, with education, I'm looking at, I think that people should be affording equal opportunity, and that's why I think education is different, because as a practical matter, I don't think racism is done as well. I don't think that's the reality, and I'm not saying it's the same nature, but because of that fact, because in the real world, you know, not everybody has had that equal opportunity to become that equally qualified candidate entering college or entering law school, I'm just saying that that's the reason for affirmative action, so that we can give them equal opportunity to pass through all the world. I myself am on a partial diversity scholarship here, and because of that, I have to maintain a GPA level, and there's lots of other scholarships, so I mean, that would be some, well, it's just an example of a way of, like, we're not just going to give you the diploma simply because you're a minority. We're going to allow you to leave the school, and then even set, in some cases, a higher standard for you to achieve to prove that you deserve to be here. And if you don't, then you lose your scholarship. I guess we would lose the interest. So okay. What I'm saying is it's opportunity, not we're going to give you the handout and just reward you for being referred.
Okay. There is hope for you. I think I can bring you along. First of all, how do you define equal opportunity?
It is very difficult. There's so many factors that are seen and unseen.
Good. Would it surprise you to learn that the black kids who were being admitted, and probably still are, for example, to Berkeley and UCLA, were kids that came from suburban schools whose parents had gone to college for the most part, who had incomes that were greatly, greatly higher than Asian and white kids, but were getting extra points to get in? Would that surprise you?
It would not surprise me, and I would say that's why it's a factor and not like. It should be a determining factor. Although I suppose, and that's why I'm saying, you know, it depends on how it's done, I guess. If it's a quota, like, you know, 20% of all applicants must be of this ethnic group, I would kind of have a problem with that. But at least allowing for it to be an important factor, I think there's a valid reason for that. Just to follow up, and the reason, and that's a good example. You know, what if somebody has had every opportunity possible, but they're also black, and you know, they live in a diversity neighborhood where, you know, their friends all cool, there's no racism, but there is still racism, you know, they still have some disadvantages, unfortunately. It might not be as prevalent as it was before, but I'm sure there are sometimes some jobs that they would apply to maybe where they got not hired simply because they were black, because that minority view of that, you know, business owner happened to be racist.
You see, in the Grutter and Gratz cases, the court made it very clear that it is not constitutionally legitimate for universities to be using race to, quote, level playing fields. They can use race in the interest of diversity, diversity of thought, and I think the court really meant racial and ethnic diversity as well, for a time. And Justice O'Connor, throughout this 25-year date. But the basic thing that those who generally want to continue this paradigm, the basic thing that they rely on is that the playing field is at level for underrepresented minorities. And we need to provide this to level the playing field. I think most people, when we talk about it, that's what they're thinking about. But the courts have not sanctioned that because of the very nature of the playing field being amorphous. What do we mean by the playing field? How do we take into account the fact that people come from different circumstances? Blacks not, are not, should not be presumed to be disadvantaged. So I think that, I'll get to you. I think that the, if you said, for example, we want to admit students because they come from unique backgrounds and they contribute to our diversity by reason of that, I think that courts allow that. If we say that we want to somehow give this extra consideration because they are purple and therefore presumed to be disadvantaged, I don't think that that meets the test. But I think more importantly, we need to be finding a way to get to that point where race is not used in American, in the American system. Your reasoning is exactly the point at which I think a very substantial number of Americans really are. Let's give extra consideration to get people on the playing field. Then after they get on the playing field, then they're on their own. But the fact is that we discriminate against some just to get on the playing field by our notion of the legitimacy of affirmative action. A lot of Vietnamese kids were more disadvantaged probably than underrepresented minorities, but they're not underrepresented minorities because their numbers are greater in the system. In the academic system, they get discriminated against. Why do we do that? But that's where this blanket policy, that's where it leads us.
Oh, I was going to ask you, you said that you propose instead of giving points to applicants based on their race, if you look at their entire application as a whole. How does that work in application? Would you have them submit a different statement, or would you use statistics? Like, how would you retrieve this information so you can decide whether or not the person is worth like to be a or the candidate that has this disadvantage? How would you, in application, how would that work out?
Well, obviously there is, the whole admissions process is one of the greatest mysteries of life. But there is an admissions package that the universities of our country have. And generally it goes through several readings, often by different people. And in that admissions package, you describe your background, they know your income, they, in most cases, they also know your racial background or your ethnic background. And quietly, I suspect that they take those things into account. You're allowed to submit a, an essay which describes your disadvantages and how you overcame those disadvantages, if you did. So the application has a lot of information, and I've gone through some norming sessions to look at the applications, and you know, there's almost too much information for us to review, but the information is there. And you just have to decide how you're going to make the choices.
I'm kind of thinking that people that do get in because of their race, people that get in by Chicago.
out on their own because they didn't have to meet the standard criteria to go against everybody in their class for 100 years. So even though we might be discriminating or it might be discriminating others, if we have an advantage, an advantage in through the door, they might not be able to keep that door open if we might just went out.
Well, that's what was happening beforehand. There were a lot of students who were admitted that weren't prepared, once you open the door, they weren't prepared to compete. Just as there are a lot of white kids who aren't prepared to compete once you open the door. But underrepresented students stick out like a sore thumb because you see them on campus and you begin to assume that they got there because of that, when often they did not. They're there like everybody else. But it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You admit a student by giving them an edge, a break to get in. They're not prepared. They flunk out. And your expectation then is fulfilled about this system that I think is an insidious one. Because of its consideration of an artificial factor like somebody's, quote, race, whatever that is. Have any of you read the work of Professor Richard Sander at UCLA? You really should. Richard Sander is an ideological liberal who has always supported affirmative action, which is an amorphous term, I stress. But he supported it. He began to look at some of his students and he concluded that affirmative action was ill-serving them, the ones who were admitted on the basis of that consideration. So he got some data to look at how do they do when they take the bar exam? How do they do when they pass the bar and then they go to look for jobs at prestigious law firms? He has concluded that race-based affirmative action results in this enormous mismatch of students going to campuses for which they're ill-prepared. They don't pass the bar the first time around, the second time around, he said. They don't get offers from the most prestigious law firms. So Sander has concluded that he's been wrong about affirmative action, that it is not a good policy, primarily because of this mismatch. So I would strongly urge you to take a look at this. He's at UCLA. Yes?
How do you race-based diversity scholarships fit into this that aren't based purely on socioeconomical factors, but based solely on race? Like, I know some people at certain schools can qualify for diversity scholarships just based on racial factors, where somebody who is not in the underrepresented class who may have that same socioeconomic factor or lower can't even apply for it because they don't have that diversity. How does that factor in? Because there's plenty of represented students like that aren't in the underrepresented minority that are still socially, economically disadvantaged. How does that fit in and how does that stack up with being the same unfairness that is but on the other side?
Well, the courts have really narrowed the use of race-based scholarships. There are some that's still there, that are still there. You can outlaw many things, but changing practices or something else. But the courts have really narrowed the use of race-based scholarships. At UC, when I was serving as a regent, they were in abundance at UC. One for white women who wanted to go into nursing. There were dozens and dozens at individual campuses for black students. They were all over the place. And we ended them because they're blatantly unfair. They breed resentment. Students that don't qualify. One day I went through a whole list of diversity scholarships at one of our campuses. You could fill a catalog of scholarships that were available for underrepresented minorities and women. I couldn't find one, not one, that a white male would qualify, for example. And if you don't think that breeds resentment, then you've never been at the house when the letter comes in to a student telling them that they didn't get admitted or they didn't get this scholarship because they didn't contribute enough diversity. UC was so dumb in its marketing that we had a letter that actually went to people that said, thank you for your application. You had a strong application, but we value diversity. Now, if you read between the lines, what is that telling you? It's telling you that you're the wrong race. You don't contribute to diversity. And so one of my first acts was, get rid of this stupid letter. Don't telegraph. Get rid of the policy, but don't telegraph that you're discriminating against people. I mean, diversity is such blather in my mind that we use that thinking everybody will just fall over and say, hallelujah, praise the Lord. They love diversity, you know. But it's now having a contrary effect. Yes?
Is that the point to say that if it seems counterproductive at the point as a child of the field that people wouldn't, or that socioeconomic factors wouldn't be the deciding factor, just to perpetuate racial stereotypes, in my opinion, because it just, in my opinion, it serves to make someone think that it doesn't have anything to do with your upbringing or your chances you have, or it is based on your race. It just seems to perpetuate stereotypes to have a policy like that instead of doing something like what you mentioned, you know, basing it more on socioeconomic factors, which really go across race lines. It has nothing to do with race in itself, but it's more on your upbringing, the area you grew up in. And that makes sense.
Well, that's the conclusion I reach, but a lot of those that still endorse race-based affirmative action, like Ms. Shanna Driver, who I understand addressed you at some point, their view is that no matter how successful you become, if you're black or Latino, you're going to be discriminated against, and that it's legitimate for the government to level that playing field by taking race into account. I think, with all due respect, they're living in a different era. America has changed so much that you can no longer use those kind of policies. But there are people that do. I mean, I just completed a campaign in Arizona. Arizona passed 60-40, the language like California's 209. Michigan passed it 58-42. Nebraska passed it 58-42. State of Washington 59-41. So those five states I tell you about because I think they are a reflection. Four of them are as blue as any states in the country. But I think that they're a reflection of how people feel about the use of race. They just don't want it used. And if you give them a choice between, quote, colorblind policies by the government and the right of government to use diversity as an excuse to discriminate, really, they go overwhelmingly for the colorblind approach because it just seems to be fair. My Uncle James had a theory that we all have a knower, K-N-O-W-E-R. You ask us certain things and we may not have a rational explanation, but we just know. We just know. And our knower tells us that. And there is a collective knower. We know right from wrong. We know that it's wrong to pick and choose on the basis of somebody's skin color. That's how we've gotten to the point now where those things are no longer in existence in the Deep South, because we just know that those are wrong. And it's going to be very difficult for a lot of those who still subscribe to this notion that race is the only way of trying to be fair to people, that they just won't come to the point of saying, okay, you're right. We get so invested in positions that we have a hard time of stepping back and saying, all right, you're making some sense, let's get rid of it. But I think if they did that, those on my side, I certainly would sit down and say, okay, let's see if we can fashion ways now to give access to more students in the college level, in the school level, because I think that while I don't reach the conclusion that you do about allowing preferences in that arena, that is the place where we need to focus more on trying to provide access so that everybody really has a chance to go and improve themselves. Not everybody needs a college education. I don't believe that's the case. Not everybody needs it. We have a lot of needs in our society that don't require that. There are a lot of people who are going to college who are wasting time and money. But I think that we certainly need to provide that opportunity for people and encourage them, if we can, to take advantage of it, but not in contracting, not in employment. We've gone totally wrong in those areas. Yes?
I have a question about admissions practices. When I read the Grutter decision, it seems pretty obvious, even though the court only narrowly allows that consideration, it seems pretty obvious to me at least that a really determined admissions board would basically, do what they wanted in terms of instituting sort of de facto quotas or whatever under Grutter.
Grutter.
Oh, Grutter, sorry. I'm curious as to what practices are like now in terms of the UC system. For instance, do good admissions committees know the race of the applicants? And if so, do they sort of wink and nod and do the same thing they would have? I'm just curious about the practices.
Well, first of all, Grutter is not as open-ended as a lot of them would like. When the court approved that, they made it clear that this was a standard of strict scrutiny. So the general counsel of most campuses are advising that you'd better cover yourself very carefully when you make these decisions. Now, one of the things that I had proposed during my stay on the Regents was that we eliminate the race boxes. My argument was, if you can't give any preference, why do you even need to know? So let's eliminate these silly little boxes that we ask people to check. The university strongly opposed that. The reason is because they wanted to know. They said, we're curious. We just want to know. Bull crap. They wanted to know because they still wanted to be able to wink and blink and to use those factors. And they require an essay. Tell us about yourself. And they think that we're so naive that we will believe that you can make true distinctions between students on the basis of a 250-word essay. So what you end up getting are a lot of misery stories. My parents split when I was whatever. My mom is on drugs. But nonetheless, I became president of the Black Student Union. Is that a Vietnamese student? Not likely. So all of those things are done, and frequently counselors at the high schools will counsel you to put that sort of stuff in there, because they are, many of those counselors at UC are the readers. So it becomes a very insidious inside game of being able to select race without race being explicitly a factor. Those practices go on all the time. And I don't think that they can be ended, candidly. At one stage, I thought it's worth the fight. I'm not so sure that it is. What we're trying to do really is to change the legal paradigm so that when you use race, you're the one breaking the law. Up until that point, we were in this novel politically correct posture where the universities could hide behind this notion of diversity being so sacred that you can't challenge it. And they're using race in very strong ways that offended even most general counsels, but they don't say anything about it. Yes?
As recently as 2006, I was in the Navy, and I was bringing it up because I think it's a big microcosm. When you look at my ship, a crew of about 400 people, there's a great disparity in the percentage of white males that are the officers and minorities of women enlisted. And for the record, my dad was a white male. The guy, the naval officer, my hero, you know, I'm not racist or anything, but I'm observing that. And this is 2006, so this is not 1964, this is now. I'm not saying, I think you're not arguing that there's no problem at all, but you're sort of saying, it seems as if you're saying, well, the racism problems are kind of over, you know, the world is different now. Like I said, this is 2006, I mean, why so many white males in the option for, and why such more many minorities and women in the listed for? That's an example.
Do you believe that there's discrimination there?
Yes.
Okay.
Discrimination, when does discrimination happen? Does it happen in the Navy? The military is great about not discriminating. I think it's a shining example of ways in which we try to at least admit that there is some racism problems. But in terms of like joining the military, no, I think it's pretty, you know, either you have a college degree or you don't, and that's exactly the point. Either you have a college degree or you don't.
But it's not that the naval.
I've actually talked to a friend of mine that's an officer now, and he feels that there's a lot, like, unless, and this is his word, if you're not a tall white male, you're just treated differently. That's just the way it is. He's just a short, kind of minority guy. I'm not saying, like, you know, people read into things all the time, you know, who knows whether that's true or not, but that was his perception, was that, you know, it's a certain sort of model of what a naval officer looks like. And from my experience, yeah, because, I mean, you look at the boards that show, you know, what people look like, and it's, you know, you just don't see a lot of minority representation. That's not to say that, did they all discriminate against people for being minorities? No, it's just, as a practical matter, I mean, is it because minorities and women are lazy or not as intelligent? I mean, I don't think it's that simple. I'm not saying they're saying that. I'm just saying that we're not obviously, like, at the point where discrimination is over, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't believe that all discrimination is over. But I also believe that nobody has a monopoly on it. And all individuals, to some extent or another, are capable of it. Yes?
I have to just comment that really quick. My boyfriend, who is a quarter Hispanic, but predominantly white, went to a traditionally all-black college that had a very strong ROTC that was putting out a good 75% to 80% Black officer candidates in the U.S. Navy. They had a very strong tie-in with other large Texas schools. And this is from the Deep South, where this, I guess, quote-unquote, shouldn't be happening, but it is. They're putting out traditionally strong numbers to show that that actually really isn't happening. There's women, there's minorities for being in all that schools. So there's whites, Asians. It's completely diverse, although it is predominantly Black, so it's collected 75% African. So on. They're putting them into the Navy, they're going to strong positions, they're being pilots, they're being all those service workers, very diverse, and the women are receiving the same scholarships as all the underrepresented and represented minorities. They're on a level playing field, they all receive the same scholarships. So, sorry, not just to count that, this is 2010, that these 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, this is happening. It's very equal and very level.
So someday you will have reflected, like, the top levels of society will work that now. Someday, perhaps.
They're saying it doesn't now. Equal scholarships to bring in, and it is, it's equal. And his father is sending kids from a traditionally white, privileged high school to this college for the purpose of the RTC program is strong. They're sending a good, diverse, good class of naval officers in. So it's showing that
we have a member of the United States Marine Corps officer for this season.
Yeah, just to back up your idea that for example, this summer, I mean, a large group of the enlisted corps themselves are minorities. And this summer, in my class of officers, I mean, a large portion were white, but of the ones that were Latino or African American, because our instructors were Latino or African American,
Yes.
I'd like to make an observation based on the collection we had. It was heartening for me to see that the young African American, who is the head of the RNC, Tom Scott, won a congressional seat from South Carolina in the majority of the white district, and that Alan West did the same thing in Florida. That a Hispanic governor won Nevada, and a Hispanic governor won in Mexico. I think when you were talking about the natural diversity, for me it was very hard to see that.
I agree with you. I think American society has changed profoundly, and it's those changes that bode well and reaffirm my view that we just need to get beyond this. When you go into that poll and you close the curtain and you vote, your true instincts come out. Your views about life really come to the front, and people are voting in very strong numbers, disregarding the factor of race. Sometimes we don't exercise the best political judgment, and I won't elaborate, but race is not often a part of the equation.
Just something that you will agree with, and I want to make that one clear, is that I will acknowledge reverse discrimination is a problem. You know, race is not a white people versus black people thing, or this color is this color.
It's all discrimination. It's no reverse. It's all discrimination.
Being like half white and half minority, we're involved. The point is, like, as a half white person involved, I got a lot of discrimination. I got practicing for no other reason than being that I was half white. You know, I was discriminated against leaving. So it does happen. It never should happen. What I am arguing, however, though, is that, you know, like those examples are good examples. The hard bit, absolutely unique. This is not, and it really means, that's something that we as a society need to admit, that there is this sort of a trend of discrimination against white people as real racism that is sort of allowed, and we shouldn't allow that. I think that needs to reverse. However, what I'm arguing is that in things like school admission policies, not giving somebody an advantage that, by you, in a sense, they don't need as much, is not discrimination in nefarious sense. It's all right.
When we were processing our bill to put the initiative on the ballot in Arizona, there was a legislator, Representative Campbell, who was asked the question in committee, how long do you think that we should have affirmative action? Because he was opposing the bill. And he said, about 400 years. And there were a lot of confused looks on people's faces. And he was basing that on the era of slavery and Jim Crow in America. And he said, we need to balance it out by giving enough time for blacks, Latinos, and women to catch up. Now, apart from that being unconstitutional, he was underscoring the sentiment among a lot of those who support preferences that there is a, quote, good old boys network, and that the good old boys are white males who somehow get together every Monday morning, as they would in Mayberry, you know, and decide who's going to get what contracts and what jobs. Life isn't that way in America. It is, if it's ever been that way, wasn't that closed of a society even back in the 60s in the Deep South. But it certainly isn't that way now. Yes, there was racism, sexism. Still a lot of those things exist in one form or another in different venues. But we have reached a place in our great nation where we can be comfortable that that is not going to be the dominant way of life in America. It's not going to be tolerated. You discriminate, and your picture is plastered on CNN and Fox News in 30 seconds nationwide. The country has very little tolerance for discrimination, very little of it. So I don't think that we have to worry about discrimination. But it always amazes me that when I defend the proposition that all people should be treated equally, I get responses from some of my opponents, why are you defending white males? And they suggest that it's sort of Uncle Tomish. My view is that if I can't defend white males, I shouldn't expect anybody to defend my rights. We purposely chose the name Civil Rights Institute to reinforce the view that civil rights belong to everybody. We sort of think that that is a term that has been commandeered by black people because of the civil rights movement. But as blacks, we were fighting for the right to equal treatment. We were fighting for the right that we should be accorded the same civil rights as everybody else. Not that this was a special slice of the pie for black people only. Civil rights belong to everybody. And we all have a duty, I think, to embrace that view. Because if we don't, then we open the door for the government to come along at any time and say, well, we don't have enough of these right now, and so we're going to give preferences here. Or we don't have enough of those right now, and we're going to give preferences here. And I can see that happening in many parts of the country where it's no longer black people who are the perceived primary beneficiaries of affirmative action. It's Hispanics. In Arizona, black people didn't oppose us. They did, but they weren't very forceful about it. It was the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. It was the Hispanic Contractors Association of Tucson. And I'm not pitting one group against another, I'm just telling you the facts. The beneficiaries have changed. And we should not be surprised by that, because any time you give preferences on the basis of race or gender, those who are the perceived beneficiaries are going to fight you if you try to take them away. If it's in real estate, if it's in farming, you take away farm subsidies, who's going to scream the loudest? Farmers. You take away the exemption for home purchases, real estate. I mean, I know something about real estate. And we fight hard against any changes in tax policy that will remove the deductibility of the interest that you pay on your home, because it would be very harmful to the housing industry. So we have to remind ourselves over and over again that civil rights belong to everybody, and that we need to defend the rights of everyone to be treated equally. And I think that once we start fudging on that, and you say, let's do it at the school level, people will drive a Mack truck through that fudging. And I just don't know how we could ever fashion any kind of system that allowed some discrimination and be true to the creed that everybody is entitled to be treated equally. I just don't know how we do that. Because having been in the educational on the Board of Regents, I can find a million ways that we can discriminate in the interest of diversity. A million ways. We can have scholarships for underrepresented students. There are only so many scholarships. When we give it to you, we're taking it away from you. We give it to you, we're saying you can't qualify for it. And I just don't think that's right. I don't know how you square that circle when you start making decisions on the basis of those factors. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for listening to me.